Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. All right, close your eyes for just a moment. Think about what America looked like, say, in 1962. The furniture, the architecture, the cars. On today's show, we'll explore the huge role Michigan had in mid-20th century design. And then, before National Fudge Day, yes, there is such a thing, we take a trip to Mackinac Island, which has a pretty legitimate claim as the modern-day capital of fudge. But first, we turn to Detroit News columnist Daniel Howes for our weekly Thursday check-in. And Daniel, the theme for today's conversation certainly seems to be the day of reckoning is at hand for Detroit.
Yeah, tomorrow at the Westin Hotel there at Detroit Metro Airport, emergency manager Kevin Orr is going to make his pitch to about 150 representatives, pension funds and bondholders and banks and unions to say, this is what we're going to want from you. And these are the kind of concessions. And it's probably going to be plus or minus somewhere around 10 cents on the dollar, which is going to be very hard for a lot of people to swallow. That number is going to go up probably through negotiations. But this is confirmation that the day of reckoning is here, that Detroit and its leadership can no longer kick the proverbial can down the road. It can't borrow any more money as a practical matter, and it's running huge deficits and is technically insolvent. And I think a lot of people think that this is clearly the precursors to a Chapter 9 bankruptcy filing, because nobody really expects that Kevin Orr is going to be able to get the agreements with all of these various parties in advance of a bankruptcy.
So tomorrow's session is really a spelling out the facts session versus a bargaining and negotiating session?
Yeah, it's really his opportunity to present the plan. And he's very explicit about he wants everybody to get it at the same time. He wants everybody to hear the same message. In fact, they're not allowing people to take in cell phones or other kinds of mobile devices so that they can't tweet and they can't make phone calls and they can't do other kinds of things and communicate with the rest of us on the outside until everybody hears the same pitch. And I think he's going to talk about the state that the city's really in, what their proposal is to get it back on track, what services are likely to be privatized, what assets may be put up for sale, you know, the entire comprehensive approach, turnaround approach for the city of Detroit, and tell the creditors, and this is the role we need you to play. My understanding is that in a situation like this, the representatives of creditors typically do a lot of listening. Mm. They've done their own analysis. They've looked at the publicly available numbers that we've already seen of the city of Detroit, the financial reports, Kevin Orr's 45-day report. They go through this, and a lot of them make an assessment about where they are and what they think they can get out of this, and also what they're willing to agree to. And in some cases, you may have financial institutions that have already written their loans and their credit lines to Detroit totally down to zero. So any recovery that they would get would be gravy, whether it's in a pre-negotiated settlement or in a bankruptcy. So each one of these is going to have a different way of looking at them. I think a lot of people feel that the biggest stumbling block in all of this is likely to be the two public pension funds, whose vested pensions are protected under the state constitution. And I can't imagine that they would agree to some kind of settlement in advance of a bankruptcy, because then they would expose themselves to lawsuits from their own pensioners.
You know, I stop and I think of those pensioners, and I think of retirees who gave the city their working years, mm-hmm. and with the expectation of pension and health care benefits. And what do you in your heart of hearts believe will be the outcome for these retirees?
Well, I think this is truly uncharted territory, and there have been bankruptcies in other states, municipal bankruptcies in Alabama, California, right. Rhode Island, to name three, and they all have had different impacts on the pensioners because the state laws are different. In the case of Michigan, you have the constitutional protection for vested benefits, and I think a lot of people just don't know how state law is going to mesh with federal law in a bankruptcy court, and the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, which limits the ability of a federal official, in this case a federal judge, to essentially dictate state law. This is truly uncharted territory. I think there is a feeling out there among the bankruptcy professionals that these vested benefits may not be as sacrosanct as pensioners have been led to believe. That's unfortunate, I think, for them, clearly. But I think the other thing we have to look at here is that and it's kind of what I wrote about today, the leadership of the city of Detroit over many years has really not been telling themselves and the voters and the residents the truth about the predicament of Detroit. They borrowed way too much money. They made promises that they couldn't keep and clearly cannot keep today financially. And now they're in a predicament where the people that are going to potentially pay are going to be retirees. Mm-hmm. By losing their health care potentially, which is not backed by any assets, unlike a pension fund. So there's a whole lot of things that are exposed here and will be the casualties of whatever happens, whether it's a negotiated settlement or a bankruptcy or both.
You know, walk us back, Daniel, in your view, let's talk a little history, because we use that term for many years. The leadership has been mm-hmm. not doing what they haven't been able to embrace the realities, and they have mm-hmm. been. How far back are we going? Are we going back pre-Coleman Young? Are we going to Roman Gribbs, Mayor Kavanaugh? How far back does this problem stem?
Well, I think you have to walk it back in steps. Let's go back to the early days of the Kilpatrick administration.
Yes.
The last time the city of Detroit had a budget surplus was 2004. So they have not had a surplus since 2004. There have been a lot of exogenous things that have happened in terms of shocks, the recession.
Sure.
They've lost – the city of Detroit, and I think I've said this to you before, has lost a third of its population roughly in the last decade or so. There is not another major city in the developed world, except for maybe Katrina-ravaged New Orleans, that has lost a third of its population. Nowhere, I can't imagine. And that speaks to – the syndrome here. These are one of the reasons Detroit is where Detroit is today is because Detroiters left Detroit. And not, I'm not talking about back in the 70s when Coleman Young was mayor. I'm talking about in the last decade. And these people were voting with their feet. They were pulling their kids out of Detroit public schools. If they had options, they left. And they came into near suburbs like from Dearborn and Southfield and various other things. And they've changed, in some senses, they've changed the political cultures in those communities as well. But, you know, the reality is that this has been building for a very long time. You've had successive administrations that have cut deals with their labor unions that were very restrictive. And if you talk to people at the state and in Lansing about some of the issues having to do with labor contracts, one of the things they'll point to are things like work rules. They'll mm-hmm. say wages are not the problem. And when you look, I've seen studies, you know, Detroit wages, for example, for police and fire are very competitive with cities of similar size and populations around the country. That's not the issue. The issue is more the total cost of those employees to the city, to the taxpayer, which takes into account pensions, work rules, and a whole lot of other things. Those are some of the problems, and those have been going on for a long time because labor contracts, by their nature, are accretive, and they build on one. It's like an onion going in a reverse way. And so
right.
instead of peeling it back, you're kind of growing it in the layers and the layers and layers. And that's kind of what you have, and it becomes very challenging. Their health care is also a huge number. It's somewhere in the neighborhood between $5 and $6 billion, and it's an unfunded liability. It's essentially a pay-as-you-go situation for the city of Detroit, and it's really unsustainable, but there are people who were promised that. And I think one of the things that's going to be litigated here is, did the contracts, are they covered by the contractual language? And that's going to be different probably for every union. This is going to be the Bankruptcy Lawyers Full Employment Act. I think you can bet on that.
Boy, oh boy. Yeah, because I think about, let's say, a firefighter who is, you know, in his 60s, early 70s. He is now retired. Probably more likely he may be suffering lung disease after years of breathing who knows what mm-hmm. going in there. And to think that health care coverage could be threatened is, I mean, you just think of the human toll of all of this, and there's a face for it.
There's no question about it, Cynthia. I mean, and I think that's the thing that's so outrageous about it. And a lot of people that have been covering this and writing about it for a long time have written about the political dysfunction in the city, where the overriding goals of elected officials were power and control. It was not competence. It was not managing to the resources that you had. I mean, as you lose population, you lose tax revenue. And as you and as people leave the housing stock in the city of Detroit, the value of the overall housing stock declines because there's less demand for it. It's a very simple supply and demand equation. So that exodus has exacerbated the problem dramatically. And it's not going to be fixed by Dan Gilbert buying buildings in downtown Detroit or Campbell Ewald moving its headquarters to downtown Detroit. That will help the central business district and it will bring some vitality. But in terms of the overall health of the city, you need to get more people there and you need to bring them back in. And I think they're going to have to get more radical about ways to do that, whether it's you don't pay property taxes for 10 years. As an example, you can come in, you can buy the house, you can renovate it, you can do whatever, and you don't have to pay property taxes for 10 years. But you're there. You're going into the local stores. You're paying other kinds of taxes in the city. And those are the kinds of things they're going to have to look at. But they've got to stop the bleeding, and they've got to get a baseline. But all that said, you're right. There is going to be collateral damage here, and I think that's very unfortunate, but that's really the reality of where we are. I think we just don't know what it's going to look like.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Always enjoy our Thursday check-ins. Daniel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Still to come, a new report takes a look at one-party control in 37 state legislatures, including Michigan. Not quite the gridlock that we see in D.C. That story's in 20 minutes. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Close your eyes for just a moment and think about America in, say, 1962. What images come to your mind? Chances are those images, whether it be furniture, architecture, cars, have roots right here in Michigan. A major exhibition that's begun at the Cranbrook Art Museum in Bloomfield Hills explores Michigan's major role in what America looked like in the mid-20th century. Much of that design is linked to Cranbrook. The exhibit is called Michigan Modern, Design That Shaped America. Joining me in the studio is the director of the Cranbrook Art Museum and the Cranbrook Center for Collections and Research, Greg Witkop. And we also welcome Greg Saldana of MPDL Studio. He's the curator of the exhibition. Greg Witkop, I'll start with you. The exhibit's focuses on Michigan's role in what's known as American mid-century modernism. Tell us, what did this time period look like and what was the feel of the time?
Well, actually, I'd like to back up just a few moments if we can, because what distinguishes Michigan as opposed to California modern is the fact that you had the constellation of these three industries here in Michigan. You had the architects that were coming out of schools like the University of Michigan and Cranbrook Academy of Art, but you also had the furniture industry, which, of course, its roots go back to when we were the basis of a lumbering center. And then you had the automobile industry. Other states might be able to claim one or two of those, but really nobody else can claim three of them. And it's out of the basis of those three industries then that this modernism in the post-World War II era really flourished, took hold here, and then permeated all aspects of culture and life in Michigan.
When we talk about this period and this term American mid-century modernism, and I know as curator Greg Saldana, that's your job is finding the best examples for those of us who are perhaps a little uneducated in the ins and outs of design and art. When we're watching AMC's Mad Men, would the look of those characters' offices and homes be good examples of this period?
Well, you know, I'm not certain about that, but I think that, you know, Greg makes a good point about these three aspects, the architecture, auto industry, and furniture industries. And the things that come to mind in terms of how the exhibit feels or how the time period feels is I think of three things: anticipation, confidence, and optimism. The country was facing World War II, and there was a lot of anticipation about the outcome. Following the war, there was even more anticipation for building the future and a great deal of confidence. So we came out of the war as victors, and anything could be achieved. And the state really did have the natural resources and the human resources.
And Michigan particularly was – things were just jamming away because the auto plants were humming and GIs came home from the war and went to college and on the GI Bill. So you're right. There was that sense of the sky's the limit.
So during the 40s and through the 50s, there was an explosion of experimentation by designers. And it was due to the constraints of the war. There was limited materials. And then there was this freedom post-war. For example, Ray and Charles Eames, both students at Cranbrook and successful designers, were experimenting with plywood in unprecedented ways, creating eventually a compound curve that would revolutionize how we experience seating. Then there was the great architect Eero Saarinen, who designed the technical centers for General Motors. And his conceptual approach was influenced by the construction of the automobile. Mm-hmm. He literally referred to the assembly line, the repetitive parts, glass and metal. And then what we should recognize as well is the University of Michigan College of Architecture launched the Architecture Research Laboratory, and it took a pioneering step in integrating design, construction, technology, planning, and research. So for instance, we had these great geniuses at Cranbrook, and we had research at University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. And it really was, I believe, due to the fact that we had these resources, these industries coming out of the war in a very optimistic view of the future.
And I want to get into Greg Wickop as director of the Cranbrook Art Museum. Talk about what it was about Cranbrook that made it such a place for rich design.
Well, I think part of it is Cranbrook from the very beginning took a very cross-disciplinary approach to design. I mean, when you talk about some of these great designers of that period, they often talk about a ceramics class that they had at the academy studying with somebody like Maya Grotel as being as influential as the work that they were doing with the designer. And so it's interesting to me to think about. Let's focus on maybe the General Motors Technical Center, when this project was commissioned by GM of Eero Saarinen, you know, this is this guy that is in his 40s, the world's largest corporation gives him the largest civilian project in the world, you know, gives it to him on a silver platter. And then he goes about not only designing the architecture of the space, but he custom designs furniture that goes inside the spaces. He asks Maya Grotel at Cranbrook to develop some special glazes that would be used for the exterior of the buildings. He works with a textile designer at Cranbrook, Marianne Strengel, to create the curtains, the upholstery materials, the rugs that were used in this space. So here is a place that is ostensibly looking at the automobile, and yet they bring a world-class architect, albeit a very young, emerging one, who then marshals all these other disciplines. And I think that that's one of the things that this exhibition is going to do. It's really going to cut through everything that was going on in the design world at that moment and really show that we had all of these pieces here at in one location.
We're talking about the exhibition Michigan Modern, Design That Shaped America. My guests are Greg Saldana of MPDL Studio. He's the curator of the exhibition. And Greg Wickop, director of the Cranbrook Art Museum in Bloomfield Hills. Greg Wickop, when you look at this exhibit, what's most exciting to you about it?
Well, I'm excited about some of the objects that are going to be a little less expected. Yes, you're going to see a classic Charles and Ray Eames lounge chair in it. You're going to see some of these icons that are known all over the world. But then you're also going to hopefully have some real surprises. Beginning right at the beginning, there's going to be a Model T from 1926 in this exhibition. You're going to say, 1926?
This doesn't sound mid-century to me.
Well, but what defines modernism more than anything? It's the modern assembly line, which was perfected by Henry Ford and working with Albert Kahn, the architect. So this Model T has a great story to it. Right from the very beginning, Henry Ford was creating an industry that could really be global. So he set up factories in Argentina in this case, but it wasn't a factory for making the parts. It was strictly a factory for assembling them. So 1926, boxcar goes down on a ship to Argentina. There's a factory down there owned by Henry Ford that assembled these Model Ts. A dealer in Argentina buys one of these, removes the metal from it, and then cuts away through every single element of this car, the engine, the filter, the tires, so that his clients coming into his showroom could see what the inner workings, the craftsmanship of this object are all about.
It's really a work of art.
This is on loan from the Henry Ford Museum. It's also interesting just that we can tell this story really by relying on the institutions in Michigan as lenders. But then there's another great object that is coming from California, from the Eames studio. Charles and Ray Eames met and married at Cranbrook. They move out to California. They're part of the war industry. How they're really perfecting the furniture industry first is working with the government, perfecting molded plywood designs that were used during the war for the inside of bombers and the like. But they also created these leg splints that most people know about that were used to help transport a wounded soldier on the field and get them into a helicopter or something. But they also designed these entire body litters where you could put an entire wounded soldier into one of these molded plywood litters and then cart them
so the medics
away,
could get them
if
off
you will.
The battlefield. Right.
There are only two of these known to exist anywhere in the world, and we have the prototype that's going to be in this exhibition. So these are just a few of the items that even if you think you know this period
– You don't.
You don't.
Yeah, it's important to mention the prototypes. So, for instance, the iconic chairs by Eames, we've been able to include three or four prototypes that I don't think most people know about. So you'll be able to see the experiments that led to the final products as well.
Must have taken a lot for Cranbrook to be able to put this all together. A lot of work gone into this.
Well, and that's where I really need to step back and talk about the partnership, because this is a collaboration that really started with the Michigan State Historic Preservation Office in Lansing. I think all of us are very proud of the fact that this started as a project 4 or 5 years ago to really lay claim to this design history that we were seeing other states around the nation claiming Charles and Ray Eames and others as their own. And we stepped back and said, wait a minute. They started here in Michigan. So this was really driven by the State Historic Preservation Office. It started as a huge research project. You know, what are the 100 modernist landmarks in the state? From there, it developed into a very robust website, Michigan Modern. From there, it evolved into a symposium that's at the beginning of this project. And then from there now, it's unfolding into the exhibition. And then hopefully the final phase of this will be a major research publication. So really the exhibition is just one component of this much larger project.
The exhibit is called Michigan Modern, Design That Shaped America at the Cranbrook Art Museum in Bluefield Hills. We've been speaking with Greg Witkop. He's the director of the Cranbrook Art Museum and the Cranbrook Center for Collections and Research, and with Greg Saldana, who's the curator of the exhibit. Thank you so much for being in with us today and talking with us on Stateside.
No, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for letting us share the story.
Virtually any woman with a special man in her life, and chances are she will tell you that when the man of the house steps outside his designated manly chores and does something that would be considered to be in her domain, that man wants praise, and plenty of it. There is something to this. A Pew Research Center survey finds of the predictors for a successful marriage, sharing household chores is number 3 on the list, just behind faithfulness and a happy sexual relationship. Well, all of this inspired a Waterford man to put on his entrepreneur's hat and come up with a new business, Man Metals, a witty but pointed way for her to dish out praise to him and for him to take a bow for helping out. Jim O'Brien's the founder of Man Metals. He joins us in the studio.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
So the goal of a Man Medal, I'm holding one in my hand now, and it says, I picked my dirty clothes up. There is a pair of men's briefs, and it says Man Medals. The goal is what?
I think the goal was to just originally, I've had this saying, if something makes you smile, giggle, or even laugh, either buy it or marry it. And I've been happily married. This is my 20th anniversary, my wife. And it was a running joke between the two of us. I would take the trash out, and like you said, men, we like affirmation. Whether we acknowledge it or not, we like to be acknowledged for what we do around the house. So every time I took out the trash or picked up my clothes, she would say, what do you want, a medal? Mm. So one day I thought to myself, yes, I do. I did the research. No one had done this. So I came up with the idea for Man Medals.
And you have, with kind of, I think, a nice nod to the hockey world, you have the original six Man Medals.
I didn't think of that. That's
yeah.
a great point.
So
okay.
run them down for us. Tell us what men can get medaled for.
Well, the original ones are the I picked up my dirty clothes.
Mm-hmm.
I put down the toilet seat. I put the toilet paper roll on, which is my best seller so far.
Okay.
I took out the trash.
Mm-hmm.
I ran the vacuum cleaner.
Mm.
And then I asked for directions, which was actually from emails from around the world. People were telling me what the next Man Medal should be, and universally, that was the most suggested one.
So this cuts across boundaries of nations. So this actually has an international resonance?
It does. I've sent Man Medals to India, New Zealand, Australia, Ireland, England, a couple in Norway. And this is all through viral discussions and good and bad about the product and just the whole dialogue about men and women and chores. It's a very interesting topic.
Jim, did you get any negative feedback? Anyone saying, you know, you're just encouraging the stereotype that guys don't help around the house or whatever?
Absolutely. No, I did. And initially, and it was funny because I learned as an entrepreneur and anybody listening right now, you have to constantly think about your message and don't assume everybody knows what you're doing.
Mm.
And I came off a little too smarmy when I first made the website and presented these things. And the fun got lost because I was trying to be the coolest guy in the room.
Okay.
So and it was conveyed as being cynical and that sort of attack thing like, oh, hey, you took out the trash, give him a medal.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to rethink how I delivered this to folks. And it really was supposed to be fun. And that's the whole point. I mean, that's why I came that slogan, you know, if it makes you smile, giggle or laugh, either buy it or marry it.
Okay.
So I have learned. And you're right. Initially, there was some feedback from bloggers, but it was interesting. Once I got into the discussion with them, it really was about how it was presented, not what it actually was.
So are there any thoughts of woman medals? And if so, what would you give a woman a medal for?
Listening to us yammer as guys sitting through a sporting event, I don't know. I mean, it's wide open to suggestion, whether it's a mom medal or whatever. But yeah, absolutely.
I think my husband would probably want a woman medal for me not talking during key moments of games. So there's an idea for you right there. And you have a military angle to
yes.
your man medal.
And that was actually from some people. I spent 8 years in the Navy. I was in the submarine service. My father served in Korea. So we started talking about a medal for men coming home. And when you come home to be a dad, being in missile submarines like I was, we were gone for 3 months at a time. And when you came back, I was always in awe of half our crew was married. So for them to leave their families for 3 months because of their commitment to the country. So the pin we made, it just says coming home to daddy. It's got a silhouette of a soldier holding up his son or daughter, his child.
Mm-hmm.
10% goes to the USO and also the Wounded and Fallen Soldiers Fund here in Michigan because it's important to me. So 10% of everyone we sell will go directly to them.
But the deep message here, I guess, really is how does a couple approach chores more harmoniously? Do you think these medals are more useful for new younger couples or old veterans?
That's a great mm-hmm. question. That's a great question. I don't know. I will say the I interact with everybody that buys them, especially worldwide, and it's all over the place, the median. There seems to be a middle ground. I think somewhere in the middle lies the peak of it. I think there's a point in your life in any relationship as it evolves that maybe you need to remind each other, you know, the shared responsibilities of household chores. But it truly is one of these things. It's a discussion that's as old as time, and it will continue. So maybe these man medals could shed a little light on it and have some fun with it, too.
Well, a pitch in. It is a team effort, and I know that we have heard it often said, happy wife, happy life.
Amen.
Jim O'Brien of Waterford, striving for happier homes all around Michigan with his man medals. Jim, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, this Sunday isn't only Father's Day, it's also National Fudge Day. We'll travel to the modern-day fudge capital, which happens to be in Michigan. Of course, Mackinac Island. That's in 15 minutes. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. One of the criticisms frequently aimed at Congress is that gridlock, where decisions come slowly, if at all, as both sides draw their respective lines in the sand, and there's just not much compromising. The result? Well, latest Gallup poll finds Americans' confidence in Congress is at its lowest level ever. Confidence in the federal legislative branch is at just 10%. That's down 3 percentage points from last year's Gallup poll. But lack of action is not the case with state legislatures across the country, where, thanks to one-party control in 37 states, we're seeing action and lots of it. State Line is an independent, nonpartisan news service of the Pew Charitable Trusts. This week, it released its annual review of state legislatures, giving us a good look at the major budget and policy developments at all 50 state capitals. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Scott Greenberger. He is an editor for State Line. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you very much for having me.
Would you agree that the big story of your 2013 legislative review is that action gap between the federal government and state governments?
Absolutely. Being here in Washington, I can tell you that it is, in fact, gridlock. There's not a lot that's going on Capitol Hill right now, but on a whole host of issues, everything from abortion to gay marriage to immigration to gun laws, not to mention health insurance exchanges and the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, states have been very, very busy, state legislatures this past session.
Scott, would you agree that having one party in control in 37 states and with a veto-proof majority, by the way, in 22 states, does that basically mean you don't have to play nice with the other team?
Yeah, that is what it means. In many states, the party in power has the party that is in the majority has the ability to push through whatever legislation it wants because it does have those veto-proof majorities that you've talked about. And that means that unlike in Washington, where the parties are pretty evenly balanced with the Senate in control of the Democrats and the House in control of the Republicans and, of course, a Democratic president, there's a lot getting done in state capitals. And what's interesting from our perspective is that they're doing very different things, though, because there are states that are blue states where the Democrats are in control and have the ability to push through what they want. And then there are red states where the Republicans are in control and they can pursue their agenda.
Which we certainly know well here in Michigan, as I'm sure you know, as you follow news from Michigan with a Republican
right.
governor and the majorities in both houses. I'm just curious, historically speaking, is this an all-time high for having one party in control in 37 states?
It is the most in 60 years, so it's been quite some time. I don't know if it's an all-time high, but it's certainly in modern times, it's a high.
Well, tell us, if you can, how as I said, we've seen here in Michigan about the agenda and the activities for a Republican legislature and a Republican governor. How does Michigan compare to what's happening in other red states?
Well, in some areas, it is similar. For example, on the issue of guns, I know that Michigan loosened some of its gun rules this year in states controlled by Democrats. For example, Connecticut and New York, they went in the other direction. On other issues, gay marriage, the blue states were a lot more active in legalizing gay marriage this year than the red ones were in placing barriers to gay marriage.
Of course, the biggest story out of, I think, politics in Lansing for us was the right to work vote that happened with the lame duck legislature late last year. And that's
exactly.
something that you have yeah. seen in your survey with a decidedly business-friendly approach in other red states.
Absolutely, but in some, I mean, also another example I should mention is Medicaid and the idea of or the question of whether to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. And as of right now, if I'm not mistaken, Michigan is one of the handful of states that's on the fence on that issue. So in that respect, it's also when you count the ones that are opposed or on the fence, it's in line with other red states.
Let's get more into contrasting what happens in a Republican state versus a Democratic. As I said, we know very well in Michigan the kind of agenda that happens when a state is red. Draw back the curtain and give us kind of a sense of the important agenda items for the Democratic state legislatures.
Well, the best example, I think, and one that we've highlighted is Colorado. That's a state where Democrats control the governor's mansion or office and both houses of the legislature for the first time in a very long time. And they've taken advantage of that to take action on many different issues. They tightened their gun control laws. They opted for Medicaid expansion. They approved gay marriage, and they also loosened their marijuana laws. In fact, they legalized recreational marijuana. So in that respect, Colorado is an excellent example of a blue state that went very far in a blue direction. Another issue that Colorado acted on, in fact, is allowing immigrants who are in the country legally to get driver's licenses.
Yes. In fact, talk some more about that immigration issue and how you see contrast between red and blue states.
Well, immigration is a particularly interesting issue because for the past several years until this year, a lot of the immigration action in the states was to restrict immigration, to make the laws tougher, stricter. And this year we saw a real difference. In this legislative session, it was the blue states that were more assertive, perhaps because of the national mood following the 2012 election. And they have pushed for driver's licenses, as I mentioned, mm-hmm. But also in-state tuition for the children of, well, particularly for children or immigrants, rather, who were brought here as children and are in the country illegally, but attend high schools in a state and want to attend college in the state. A lot of blue states acted to grant them in-state tuition.
Are we seeing a shift in the positions of Republican state legislatures just based on what we're seeing on a national level after, as you cited, the November election was kind of a clarion call to many in the GOP about where to stand on immigration?
Well, yes, absolutely. I think that the fact that President Obama won such a huge proportion of the Hispanic vote in the election and the sense among Republicans as well as Democrats that was really decisive, and that you see the National Republican Party trying to change its image, if not its policies, and perhaps its policies as well on immigration. So I think that that's... you know, that's an issue where we've seen quite a lot of movement and a pretty significant shift this year.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Scott Greenberger, who is an editor for Stateline. Stateline's an independent, nonpartisan news service of the Pew Charitable Trust. And every year they come out with their annual review of state legislatures. It gives us a look at the budget and policy developments at all of the state capitals. What can you tell us about the differences between red and blue states in how to spend public dollars? What are the priorities?
Well, in many of the reddest states, with state revenues starting to recover finally from the downturn, there were tax cuts for the first time in several years. States such as Indiana, close to you, cut taxes. But in bluer states, they used the surge in tax revenues for different purposes. For example, in Illinois, also nearby, they used their extra money to pay down some of their debts. And I know in Michigan, revenues were also up considerably. And there was a lot of talk in the legislature this year to use some of that money to fix roads. And I believe you considered a big tax increase to pay for that effort. But that's
still being bandied about.
Right now.
Yes.
Yeah, still still being bandied about. But and then of course there are other states that have benefited greatly from the new oil boom. States such as North Dakota and Alaska were able to cut taxes because they got a huge influx of new revenue from the oil and gas industry. So it really, as you might expect, in the redder states, there was at least an attempt in many of them if the revenues were healthier to cut taxes. Whereas in blue states, another one that comes to mind is Minnesota. There was an effort to take some of that money and try to create jobs by investing in infrastructure or other sorts of public projects.
I get the sense that as you did this review of the issues and the decisions that have been tackled in all the state capitals, the Affordable Care Act, it sounds like that is going to be one of the major stories looking forward as we track what legislatures are doing. Break that down for us.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's a huge change that's coming very quickly, and states, the decision or the debate over whether to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act has grabbed a lot of headlines, but certainly that's a very important issue affecting millions of people. But in addition to that, the states have had to decide how they're going to set up and run their health care exchanges, which is another part of the Affordable Care Act. They had the option to run it themselves or let the federal government run it or run it in partnership with the federal government. And then in addition to that, there's kind of the nitty-gritty, the technical aspects of that, choosing the plans that are going to be offered and what the sort of rules are going to be and how are states going to cut down on fraud when there are going to be a lot more people coming into the Medicaid system. So there are a lot of different aspects to the Affordable Care Act, kind of rubber hits the road sort of aspects to it that states have been grappling with this past legislative session.
And we can, I'm sure, expect this to be going on literally for years, right?
Oh, that's right. With a law this big, absolutely. And there will be, I'm sure, in a law that's this far-reaching as it rolls out and people see the way it actually works or doesn't work, there will be calls to tinker with various things or change various things. I mean, that's what happened when these programs, Medicare and Medicaid, were first implemented back in the 60s or first approved back in the 60s. There have been many, many changes since then. So I think we can expect states, lawmakers, and governors to be dealing with these sorts of issues for years to come.
What overall, taking maybe the 35,000 foot in the air view of America, Scott Greenberger, what would you think that this whole story of 37 states with one party, in control, what does that say about politics in America today?
Well, I mean, I clearly, and I wouldn't be the first to say this, I mean, we are, in many cases, we are split as a country. I mean, our politics is very polarized. On the other hand, I mean, I think you can also take a positive view of this. If you live in a state where one party, where the people of the state have elected one party to run, to be a representative of that party to be governor and also to run the legislature, the legislative chambers, then they should be getting things done. And if the voters don't like what they're doing, they can boot them out and elect members of the other party. But I think it makes sense that when people are elected and they're elected or campaign to do certain things, that when they get to the state capitol, whether it's Lansing or any other state capitol, they actually do what they say. If the voters don't like it, they should choose someone else.
Scott Greenberger, thank you for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Greenberger is an editor for Stateline, an independent news service of the Pew Charitable Trusts. On Sunday, you might want to do something besides that old standby, the tie for good old dad. You might want to present dad with a pound of fudge. Since it's not just Father's Day, it's also National Fudge Day. By most accounts, the first batch of fudge was concocted in Baltimore in the 1880s. but by the turn of the century, fudge making arrived in northern Michigan on Mackinac Island, which today has a legitimate claim as the modern-day fudge capital. Michigan Public Radio's Rick Pluta reports.
Tourists pile off ferries and onto Mackinac Island by the thousands every day during the summer. For many, one of the first stops when they arrive, or one of the last before they board a ferry back home, is one of the island's 15 or so fudge shops.
Which one do you like? You want the Rocky Road? Is that your favorite?
Janet Snyder is here with her daughter, Madison, examining rows of different flavors.
I already bought peanut butter. So my husband's request to bring peanut butter fudge home because he couldn't come today.
But island-wide and here at Liba's Fudge Shop, the favorite is plain, unadulterated chocolate fudge. Meet Ed Turbin.
I'm the fudge maker at Liba's Fudge Shops. We start with the basic ingredients, the sugar and the corn syrup and the cream and the chocolate. And we blend those all together and mix them and cook them in the big copper kettle up to 232 degrees. When it gets to that temperature, we bring it out and we pour it here on the marble slabs into this frame.
After the mixture cools a bit, Ed Turbin goes to work, mixing, twisting, and flipping the fudge, lifting it into the air and slapping it down. It's a storefront operation. Tourists stop to watch through the window or they stroll into the store. Turbin says he's not just a fudge maker, he's a showman.
In fact, when no one's around for me to interact with, it's really a kind of a dull job for me just to make fudge. I know how to make fudge, but if I can do it for people and they come and they talk and they want to taste and, you know, they all ask the same questions, but they don't know that the last person asked the same question, so it's all new to them, so I treat every one of them like it's the first time.
So what are the questions?
Do you ever get it on the floor? Do your arms get tired? How long have you been doing this?
Told me that. So do you ever get it on the floor?
Never.
Do your arms get tired?
All the time. I'm tired right now.
And how long have you been doing this?
For 31 years.
What's unique about Mackinac fudge is the way that it's made on the marble slabs, large batches at a time, in a very dramatic process.
Phil Porter is an island resident who wrote a short history of Mackinac's fudge business. He says candy has been a popular foodie souvenir here since Mackinac Island became a popular tourist destination in the late 1800s.
And one of the things that people did on vacation back then was that they liked to enjoy candy. Today we accept candy as an everyday phenomenon. Back then it was a treat. It was a treat that you did on vacation.
At first, the mainstay was maple syrup candy in little birch bark canoes. It was a cottage industry for nearby American Indian tribes. The candy shops expanded their sales over time to include taffy and peanut brittle. But Phil Porter says Mackinac's confectionery future was in fudge. By the 1920s, fudge shops lined the streets of Mackinac's downtown. Porter says electric fans pushed the smell into the streets, streets emptied of cars and trucks since they were banned in 1898.
And pretty soon people were like Pavlov's dogs. They had no choice but to go in and buy the fudge. And it's taken off since then.
The most common forms of transport on the island are bikes and horse-drawn carriages. On a hot summer day, the smell of fudge cooking wafts from the shops and combines with what the horses leave in the streets to make a visit to Mackinac a unique olfactory experience. For Stateside, I'm Rick Pluta on Mackinac Island.
And a very important note from Rick Pluta. He tells us if you do buy fudge this summer on Mackinac Island, do not refrigerate it. That actually dries out the fudge. So if you absolutely need to, it's much better to freeze it. Thank you so much, Aunt Rick. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered by Peg Watson today. Our contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock.